Juliet Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you.
Hello and welcome to episode 277 of Dogcast Radio, which lives online at dogcastradio.com. I'm going to spoil you in this episode because we have not one, not two, not even three, but four interviews and actually five interviewees. Call it a summer special if you like, but it's definitely a bumper issue. We'll be talking history in the making as Great Britain sends their first ever senior team to the World Agility Championships this month.
We decided that it would be a great idea if we actually sent a senior team because we've got lots of very good senior handlers in the country that probably haven't got the speed that the younger handlers have got, but all the skill set.
We'll have the tale of an escapee kitten worthy of a Disney film.
The family went on vacation, so Daisy went to a kennel. First night that she was there, Daisy slid open the door, popped out the screen, and escaped.
And we'll have the issue of euthanizing pets without consulting the owner or contacting the registered microchip owner first.
This is something that could affect anybody. It's not a one-off. It's not just, you know, for rescues. It could happen to anybody. You know, if you've got a cat that you let the cat out, could happen to you. If you've got a dog, the dog's let off lead. If you let the dog in the garden, could happen to you.
Before that, and you would not believe how long I've agonised over the running order of this podcast, we have Tripod Super Dogs, a celebration of three-legged dogs inspired by photographer Sarah Loveland's own tripod dog, Ruby. This has developed into a project which focuses on eight dogs. And right now, until the 1st of September 2024, there's an exhibition of the portraits of the Tripod Superdogs at the Land of Oak and Iron in Newcastle in the UK. If you're not lucky enough to be near enough to pop along to the exhibition, you can visit sarahloveland.com to see the beautiful portraits she took of the dogs. And of course, right here on dogcastradio.com, you can hear interviews with all the tripod owners. I highly recommend you visit both websites because this is not just a celebration of the dogs, but also of the love between the dogs and their people. In this podcast, I'm going to share with you my interview with Sarah Loveland.
Let's start off with what it actually is. Let's tell people what it actually is. So it's a tripod project, isn't it? What's a tripod?
Tripod is a dog with three legs. Tripod is the three-legged part and then the D on the end dog. So quite often you'll see it written as a tripod with a dog with a D on the end. It's basically, it's a dog with three legs. You do get other animals, you know, cats and things that also have three paws. But this project is focusing on dogs.
Right, maybe we'll move on to cats next.
Maybe that's next.
Yeah, we'll get this one done first. But, yeah, and let's be very clear, this is a celebration, isn't it? This isn't a commiseration. This is a celebration.
Absolutely. My mind was completely blown by what I've seen and experienced when meeting these dogs. And I just like so strongly believe that we need to celebrate them and they are actually super dogs. They are totally amazing.
Yeah, I have thoroughly enjoyed learning all about them and meeting, you know, e-meeting all the people and many of the dogs. It's been fascinating, really, really interesting. So let's talk about the dog that started it all off. Let's talk about Ruby.
Yeah, sure.
When, I mean, she was beautiful, but when Ruby first came into your life, take us back to that. What was Ruby like when you met her?
Crazy.
Yes.
Ruby came to us when she was about 18 months old. She was a rescue. She came over from Ireland.
Yeah.
And when I first saw her in the kennels, she was completely switched off. And she's a ginger kind of lurchery kind of dog. So yeah. Very fast on her feet. And one of the other dogs that I owned at the time liked that kind of breed to chase and play with. He was very uncertain of lots of other dogs, but he liked that breed. So I was drawn to her. And she was crazy. She had springs in her feet. She'd be on the dining room table. It would be high-speed laps around the lounge, up and over anything, you know. We used to call her our ginger nutter because she really was completely, she'd just be quiet. And then suddenly this burst of energy would come from nowhere and she would literally, if she could have been on the ceiling, she would have been. Yeah, she was very, very lively.
Yeah.
And even, you know, before she had to lose a leg, she was still running around at speed at 13 years old.
Wow.
So she was 13, but she would still give my younger dogs a run for their money on a field, high speed, fast laps of the field. She loved the chase and run. Yeah,
but I remember. Is it my imagination or did you call her Kangaroo? She was like a kangaroo.
Yeah, Ruby Kangaroo.
Yes.
Yeah. The day we brought her home, she literally jumped over a 6-foot fence. And I thought, we had to move some things around in the garden so she couldn't do that. She literally had springs. She would literally do like a lurcher leap. So to the long grass, she would be boinging up over the top of the long grass.
Yeah.
Very much like a kangaroo on her back feet.
Yeah. Oh, bless. See, we all have, I think all of us have that, what have I done moment, whether it's a puppy or an older dog, you kind of go, what have I done? Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Oh. We keep us on our toes for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Bless her. She was full of life. So now, take us to how did Ruby lose a leg?
She had been running around as normal with my other dogs. And then later in the day, she was limping a bit. We thought, okay, maybe she's just pulled a bit of a muscle because she's 13 and, you know, she's running around at high speed and maybe, you know, she's just like tweaked something. Something's just pulled a little bit of a muscle or something. So we kind of like kept an eye on it for a day or two and thought, no, this isn't right. To the vets we go. So our vet is absolutely amazing and lovely. And she had a good look at her and she thought, yeah, maybe it's a muscle and we'll have some, you know, the good old, some meds, anti-inflammatory meds to see if, and to rest it as much as possible and see if that makes a difference. And over the course of a week, it wasn't getting better. If anything, it was getting worse.
Oh.
And the meds weren't working. So I took her back to the vets for a recheck. And our lovely vet said, well, let's just do an x-ray just to be on the safe side to see if there's anything going on. Unlikely, but we'll have a look.
Yeah.
So sure enough, had an x-ray and the x-ray flagged up straight away that the bone didn't look quite right. It wasn't as dense as it should be. And then there was concerns then that it was cancer in the bone.
Yeah.
So the next step was to do a biopsy. Also, there's a risk with that because obviously it's a big needle and it can cause more damage to the bone if it's already really weak. But they kind of already knew that it was likely to be cancer from what they were seeing.
Yeah.
But perhaps we caught it, you know, fairly early. But generally speaking, if it's showing up in the x-ray, it's there and, you know, it's likely to appear somewhere else. So although we wait a couple of days or so for the biopsy result, the kind of the question mark was, what do we do? Do we, you know, we could operate and remove the source of the pain. Because she was in an incredible amount of pain.
Oh, bless.
On a lot of meds, and it wasn't really, you couldn't touch the leg. And this has gone from high speed running to not being able to even touch her in the space of 2 weeks. It was very, very quick. And then we had to look at all of the options, and we did have to look at the facts and say, look, okay, she is 13. What is it going to look like? You know,
because
in my mind, I'd never met a dog. I'd not even met one briefly that had three legs, but I'd never known anybody that had been through it.
Yeah.
And I was like, so I was doing, you know, good old Google, having a good old look through, getting as much information as I could. And the prognosis wasn't looking great. It was kind of like, well, if we do amputate, we may only have 4 months. And then, so to humans, although she wouldn't be in any pain, so it'd be a pain-free 4 months. You're thinking, is it worth putting her through, losing a leg for 4 months? And then that's kind of, so you're having to answer some sort of big questions in your own mind.
Yeah.
But dogs, but at that point, you have to remember that 4 months to a dog is a long time.
Yeah.
They very much in the moment.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it becomes very complex, these equations that you're doing and balancing and sort of, how much of this am I doing for the dog? And if I think it's for the dog, is it genuinely for the... And you can't analyse that. And how much is it for me? Oh, my goodness. It becomes very, very complicated very quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it has to be quick as well, because you're thinking, well, if she has got cancer, you need to remove that from the body.
Yeah.
And also, in fact, she was in pain. We didn't want her to be in pain. So we had to make quite quick decisions. And it was right before Easter. But something, you know, where you think, well, we need to make a decision. We're going to do this now. But yeah, I had to really make sure that we were doing it for her and not for me.
Yeah.
Because we didn't want to lose her. Because we'd, you know, about a month before lost another dog.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, are we really going through this again? And is this the best thing for Ruby? But my vet was very good. And she is very experienced and has her own dogs of different ages and breeds and things like that. She had experience as well with, you know, treating other dogs with this condition.
Yeah.
And she's a Rebus Frayne. In fact, she's quite springy, and she's quite, you know, springy on her back feet as well. You know, she felt she would cope well with having the three legs. That was a big factor. She was already on some meds for a little bit of a sore back. So we had to bear that in mind, that taking a leg away was going to have a little bit more of a impact on everything else.
Yeah.
So in my mind, in my heart, I knew that that she would cope
with it. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I thought, right, no, this is what we're going to do. And then I had to prepare my husband Jeremy as well. Then this is what it's, because I was doing all the research. He was a bit like, he couldn't look at it. So kind of like, you know, it's going to be what it's going to be, kind of thing. And I had to kind of like do the research. Yes, it's okay. Because I can't believe it to start. Because the vet said, I said, how long will it take her to recover from having her leg amputated? We're maybe only going to get 4 months. And she said 2 weeks.
Wow.
I said 2 weeks?
Yeah.
I go for a long run, and sometimes I think, oh, it's raging.
True,
telling me you can remove a leg from my dog, and she'll be as happy as anything on no pain meds in 2 weeks. And she goes, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Joking. But I also couldn't believe that. So I can't believe this is actually true. Because you see, like, what humans do. If you can break a leg, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it takes like weeks and weeks to heal and all this kind of thing. Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So with all the facts on board, we said, yeah, let's do the operation and we will help her the best we can.
Yeah.
And very much I went into it wanting to be led by Ruby rather than, you know, this is how it's going to be. And we're just going to take it one day at a time and just see how she is and how she copes with it.
Yeah.
It completely blew my mind. Incredible. She stayed in overnight. She had the operation, stayed in overnight so she could have some pretty heavy duty, kind of like pain meds.
Yeah.
And she was on pain meds and stuff. And when we went to collect her, the vet met us first, prepared us, you know, what it would look like. And, you know, and then Ruby hopped out with a nurse on her own. She just hopped.
Wow.
Towards us. And I said, do I need parents? Out to the car, and they said, no, she can do it. And I was thinking, yeah, that's, you know, this is massive. And so, you know, they said, just do a few steps, let her have a rest. And she'd always like lean against me, have a few steps and lean, you know, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
Tricky to pick up a dog with three legs, though, I have to say.
Yes.
Like, where do you put your hands? She had a massive, they took the shoulder blade as well. So she had a massive wound.
Yeah.
So it's a bit tricky. That was a bit like that.
Yeah, especially in the early days when it's all raw and sore, you don't want to sort of touch the wound, do you?
No. So it was, that bit was quite tricky in and out of the car. But other than that, I did a mad dash out to the supermarket for some boys aged 5 T-shirts. He cut the sleeves off and stitched them up. And then, so she had a T-shirt. She had a wardrobe for a week, different T-shirt. And so that so she didn't lick it or bother the stitches and things like that.
Yeah.
Also, so we didn't scare anybody when we were out.
Oh, bless.
Fairly, you know, Frankenstein's dog when you've had a big, you know, injury like that.
Yeah, because they shave as well, don't they? So much is shaved and you can see.
Massive area.
Yeah.
But yeah, she came home and she looked fairly bright and it was all good. And
Just
amazing. The first couple of nights were a bit tricky. I sort of slept on the floor with her, and as you do, you know, the dog, as we do, we do sort of like do that. But yeah, I think it was even just like the next. We've got a grass playing field right opposite our house, and they love getting over there, and we let her sort of hop over there, so she could have a sniff about and hopping around. And each day, she just got faster and better at it. And it was okay. And I threw the ball for the other dogs on the date, and then she ran after it. And she said, I didn't get that. And I was like, oh no, what's, you know, like look of panic on my face. And well, and he said, well, okay, if she wants to go for the ball, she can go for the ball. That's fine.
Oh, bless her, bless her.
Yeah. So we just very much were led by her on a day by day basis rather than trying to like, no, no, you can't do that or you can't go there. Well, yeah. She'd say, I'd want to go on the sofa and you'd have to put her quick and lift her up because you had to be a bit careful with things like that.
Yeah.
But generally, yeah, I just couldn't believe it. And sure enough, yeah, within two weeks, the stitches were all out. And she was on some meds, but only because of her age, really, and her back, you know, a bit sore. And,
oh.
Yeah, and she had started physio. So she had a monthly, four-week physio appointment where she'd have a massage.
Yeah.
A bit pampered. And, yeah, life went on.
Oh, so I mean, yeah. did she kind of go back to being Ruby, the Ruby you'd known, that full of energy Ruby and full of life?
Yeah, that cat, the cheekiness, she was definitely very much herself.
Yeah.
She didn't seem sad at all, anything like that. She was very much like, right, well, what are we going to do now? Or they go and pick the dog leads up, because we've always had like more than one dog. She would be at the front of the queue to have her harness put on and stuff like that. So we had a harness so that we could help her more the lifting in and out of the car and helping things like that.
Yeah.
And then she'd have days where she'd go, right, I'm going to chase those boys around the field. and she would.
Oh,
so yeah, very much herself. But yeah, her personality didn't change at all.
No, bless her. No. I was thinking, as we're talking, dogs benefit so much from, you know, psychologically. They don't worry about the what ifs. They don't have that poor me. And they don't worry about what do I look like, you know? They just, okay, I'm here, I'm having fun. Okay, off we go. That's all they care about, isn't it?
Yeah. There's me putting T-shirts on so that she doesn't keep anybody else out, but she was not bothered at all.
Yeah,
she just wanted to be out. She wanted to be out with the other dogs and not missing out on stuff. And we used to do things like we did buy it. Well, we already had it from the previous dog, like a pushchair buggy thing.
Yes, yeah.
Whereas if she got tired, she could hop in because you kind of had to build up what she did gradually.
Yes, yeah.
So that the other legs could get used to taking the weight and she'd stand slightly differently. So the other leg would come across towards the centre a little bit more. And her back legs would stand slightly wider, so she had pretty much a good tripod kind of stance about her.
Yeah,
we did build up stuff gradually and made sure she didn't overdo it.
Yeah,
Which was a bit tricky to start with in terms of that, because sometimes I think she would, you know, if we were on the playing field and she saw a dog the other side, she would go, "I'm going over there."
Good for her.
At 13, I don't know what age it starts, but it's usually perhaps like after 10, they decide the rules no longer apply.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, doesn't matter how much training you've done from a youngster up, they reach an age where you go, and they go, oh, no, go over there.
Yes. Even with three legs, I can still outpace you. I'm going.
And how fast they can actually move, even on three legs, if there's a Labrador over the other side of the field, they are going to go and say hello.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
But yeah. No. She was. Her personality didn't change at all. She was very much Ruby right through. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Good for her. That's amazing. And of course, when she did get over the other side of the field, the other dog would just accept her and just play, and everything's happy.
Yeah. Well, there was one time I had her on the lead, and she didn't really like. She would like prefer to be off the lead. So I had her off the lead, and there was another Labrador. Labradors are her favourite.
Yeah.
Very, very big Labrador. And she was really excited to see this dog. And the guy had put the dog on the lead because Ruby had three legs.
Yeah.
He goes, I don't want him to knock her over.
Oh.
Because he was a big, big dog.
Mm.
Similar age to her. I said, don't worry about it. So he let him off. He had a little chase around. I was thinking, it's enough now. I was always worried that she might overdo it or something like that. But she's like, no, we're going to have a play now. Reactions from other people have been very interesting.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you do get that, oh, no, what's happened? You know, what's happened? You're right. Well, she's amazing.
Yeah. I do that myself. Though. I even now I'll see it. I saw one the other day, three-legged little dachshund in a pram, and I went over and said, oh, can I sit? And you do get that instinct. Can I? But they aren't to be pitted, are they, at all? They're still in the midst of life and having fun.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think when I made the decision to have the operation, I worried a little bit that I might get judged, I think, by other people, whether it be on Facebook, social media, or out, because she is 30, was 30 then, that they might think, am I doing the right thing? Whereas I was quite confident in my decision that it was the right thing.
Yeah.
But you do think, what are other people thinking? Are they judging me as a dog owner?
Yeah.
You know, but it is interesting. And this is the thing, it's kind of, I might have thought that about other dogs before, and now, like, no way at all. It's been absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Both Ruby, how she coped with it all, and the other dogs that I've met as part of this project. It's been absolutely amazing.
Yeah, we'll come on to that, but I just wanted two things there about judging that I just wanted to talk about. So yeah, I think that's a really important point, that whatever decision you make, as long as it's you're making it for the dog, whether you decide we're going to go ahead and we're going to have, you know, we're going to lose that leg and then the dog's going to, we're going to buy the dog some time hopefully, or whether you decide that's not the course that you and that dog are taking, I think we have to trust that the owner is making that decision on an individual basis for their dog, and as you say, and not judge, just try and support.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, we know our dogs the best.
Yes.
We know what they're like at home and what they're capable of and what their quality of life is like. And it's that quality of life that is the most important thing. If it's going to impact and they're not going to have a great quality of life, then it's a different decision to be made. But I think, you know, we all know ourselves the best, you know?
Yeah.
We all know our dogs the best too.
Definitely.
I think. Well, sometimes they think they know better, but but we know.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing, you know, using strollers or pushchairs or prams or whatever mobility aids for them, again, we had to use one with our Bichon Frise, who had cruciate ligament surgery. And so she was in a stroller, just briefly. And I got so cross with people judging that I put a big label on it saying, you know, I am recovering from cruciate ligament surgery. Again, the odds are that person is using that stroller or pushchair or whatever for the dog's good. So again, you know, by all means, go over and say, oh, hi, why are you using a stroller? Have the conversation. Don't judge, though, because it's probably for a jolly good reason.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's not something we take lightly. But it's kind of like, you know, it's something that makes their quality of life even better.
Yeah.
And we bought it for the dog that we'd lost earlier at the start of last year. And that transformed his quality of life.
Yeah.
Because then he could come out with the younger dogs. And that's, you know, they're part of the family. And then they want to be part of the family. They don't want to stay at home and they're in their bed or crate or on the sofa while you're all out having a good time.
Yeah.
They want to be there too. So we have to do whatever we can so that they can.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you did buy Ruby a lot more time, didn't you, with the loss of the leg? That, and it was good quality time. But she did have a lot more time, didn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. So we thought we might get 4 to 6 months because we didn't do chemotherapy as well. We did just the amputation. And that was because she was older, we felt like she needed to be having good time out, not lots of vet appointments.
Yes.
So we thought maybe 4 to 6 months, and we got 9 months, heading towards 10 months with her.
Yeah.
And she was very, you know, she had a really good quality of life right up to the end. It was very quick, the downward kind of spiral on that. She absolutely lived her life to the full. You know, even Christmas, we didn't think we'd get Christmas all together, and we did, and we went away all together, and she had a lovely Christmas.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
And as you say, that 9 months is a big chunk of a dog's life, so that's a significant time that you got her, and good quality time. Yeah, happy time.
Yeah. Get a couple of good, some good holidays and trips out, and days out, and things like that.
Yeah.
Lots of fun with the younger dogs, and we did what we could to kind of maintain her, like, so she'd have the physio appointment every 4 weeks to massage her back.
Yeah.
So we'd go and lie on this pink mattress like a princess.
Oh.
demands to be massaged.
Good for her. So then, as you're I won't say dealing with this life, because it wasn't like dealing with, but as you're adjusting to life with a three-legged dog, which is not as big an adjustment as you maybe had anticipated. So then, was it that you sort of started meeting lots of other owners of other three-legged dogs?
I joined right before we had the operation, when I was in that horrible space of trying to make decisions. Yeah. I did a little search on Facebook to see if there were any groups. And I found a couple of groups on there, one which had a lot more owners from abroad, from the United States. And then there was one that was a UK based. So I kind of joined these groups because I wanted to do more research, make the best decision. And that kind of, in there were videos of their dogs running and playing and doing all these amazing things. And I was like, wow. I didn't even think, that there were so many dogs out there. This was perhaps such a more of a normal thing than perhaps, I was aware of, and also what the dogs were able to do.
Yeah.
And it's so positive in there, in these groups. And that made me aware that suddenly there's lots of people going through what I was going through or had been through, and their dogs were like living their lives to the full.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. It was amazing to see. And that really helped me make my decision.
Yeah.
But also how amazing these dogs were.
Yeah. Yeah, brilliant. And which led you on to this tripod project. And then you've taken lovely, you're a photographer. Obviously, you're going to take nice photos, but they are beautiful photos of the other tripods in the project. And it's beautiful. And it really does capture, when you look at them, they're not stationary. I mean, they're dashing through the waves or they're running in the field. Yeah. They're active dogs. They're dogs, aren't they?
Yeah, well, it's with Ruby. There's a Ruby. But also lots of pictures of her before, but also after the operation and things like that. And I thought, wouldn't it be lovely to be able to showcase some of these other dogs and what they can do? So I'd shout out in the Facebook group to see if anybody was where they were in the country and would they be interested in having a little photo shoot with me so I could meet them. So we did that. So we met up and gas, and it was important to me to capture the dogs and set up a studio set up where they were just sitting and smiling at the camera, like a school photo. But I wanted to capture more of their personality and what they liked to do, what they love, what they really love to do. So that's why we kind of did photo shoots outside, them doing things that they loved, which was absolutely amazing. And it was, one of the photo shoots we did was with a lovely dog, Bella, and it was at the beach. Went to the beach because she loved the beach.
Yeah,
and it was actually the first time she was at the beach since the operation, because she wasn't long post op.
Yeah,
so it was her first visit back to the beach, and it was amazing for me to be able to photograph her and capture that moment.
Yeah,
at the beach, it's just incredible. I mean, that would be one moment that really sticks in my mind, because we picked a bit of beach where there's just a couple of steps so she could be lifted down onto the sand. So it's like, and we also picked the time so the tide was barely in, so she didn't have too far to go because she was water obsessed.
Yeah.
And her lovely owner said, she might just run in, she might want to go, she'll probably want to go in the sea for a paddle. But as soon as we hit the sand, she took one look at us and she goes, "I'm going in the sea." And she legged it down the sand straight into the water. And we were like,
"Oh, bless."
And then the puppy goes, "Oh, what's happened to her? Is she all right?" And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, she's fine." It's just so fun. We just laughed and cried at the same time, because it's such an amazing moment to see her. She wasn't going, "Oh, well, I've only got three legs now, I can't do it."
Mm.
She was like, "I'm going in the sea. Bye."
Yeah. Whether you like it or not. Yeah. See you. Yeah. Bless. Yeah. I mean, I think that sums up my experience of chatting to the owners. When you say we laughed and we cried, I think that sums it up well, because, I mean, dogs, they do live in your emotions, don't they? Live in your heart. And it stirs up the very strong emotions. But it was, I was going to say, looking at those photos, you can see the joie de vivre, the joy those dogs still have. And that's clear from the owners. But, again, the owners have been through that psychological aspect of of your dog losing a leg. So I think that's something. Zoe was laughing and crying, but in a good way.
Yeah. And they've all lost legs for different reasons and things like that. So, you know, some you know, is a result of cancer. Some, you know, simple as, you know, breaking a leg whilst on a walk you know, in some kind of accident at home in the garden. And just things you don't expect or plan for. So, you know, it's they have all been through big stuff, but sometimes I think it's harder for us humans than it has been for the dogs in most cases, I would say.
Yeah.
Most cases they've just got on with it and shown us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would agree. Yeah. Is there anything that you'd like to say to people, whether they know nothing about three-legged dogs, they've never met one, whether they're facing that decision, or, you know, when you're out and about and you meet a three-legged dog, what would you like them to know about three-legged dogs?
All dogs are so resilient and amazing, and they do very much live in the moment. So if they're out, they want to be out. You know, if they're chasing the ball, they want to be chasing the ball. They're doing exactly what they want to do in that moment, and it's just sort of more awareness, really, that actually, you know, dogs can always teach us a lot in terms of that living in the moment and making the most of each day, and that they are really amazing. They have so much courage and resilience. Yeah, like little superheroes, really, with three paws.
Oh, that's lovely. I love that. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
If you're in the position where you're making this difficult decision, then you know your dog the best. You know what they're capable of. You can be guided by, you know, the information on the internet, and a good vet will help to guide you as well. I was very lucky in the sort of people that I had around me that, I've had dogs for a long time, so I'm very confident in the sort of the advice that I was, you know, being given. But yeah, but at the end of the day, you know what's right for you and what's right for your dog first. You and your dog as a team, you know, you've both got to work through it together.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, dogs, I'm a dog lover through and through. I always have been. So it's hard to see. You don't want to see your dog in pain at all.
No.
But yeah, so you do what you can to give them the best lives that you can. You know, particularly like Ruby, she was a rescue. So we always said that. When you get a rescue, they rescue you.
Yeah.
As much as anything else, they teach you a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah. She was very special. She was a very special dog. Sadly, you know, we lost her to the cancer. It did come back, which we knew it would, because they generally, if it's in the blood, it's going to reappear somewhere.
Yeah.
But we had a lot longer than we thought we were going to.
Yeah.
And we were very grateful for that.
Yeah. I'm sure she was too. Yeah. Bless her. She was lovely.
Yeah.
Absolutely lovely. And again, I guess if anybody is going through this, if they're struggling with a decision, or if their dog has lost a leg for whatever reason, it is important to say, come and check us out. Come and check out the Tripod project. But also, as you say, go onto social media. You will find other people. The support is there. The camaraderie is there. So find that support.
Absolutely. And when I put the shout out for people for photo shoots on for this project, two of the people, they lived very close to each other. And they had never met. So they kind of did the photo shoots back to back at the same place. And then they got to have a chat as well, which was really lovely. So there is a lot of support out there in these groups as well, which is lovely. It's just lovely to see what, you know, dogs can do, you know?
Yeah. Is your website a good place for people to go to as a start to see some lovely photos of the dogs and find out more about the project?
My website, sarahloveland.com, there's a page, because it's going to be an exhibition where people can sort of see the pictures locally to me, but also they'll all be on the website as well. So if you're not local or you're, you know, further afield, then you can still see the pictures and hear the stories about the different dogs and how amazing they are.
Excellent. Sarah, I'm really glad that Ruby found you, because you've been a brilliant advocate for her, as you are with all your dogs. And so I'm glad for her that she found you. I'm glad for you she found you. Sometimes the right person and the right dog just find each other, don't they?
Absolutely. I'm a big believer in that. Yeah. But, you know, things do happen for a reason. And You know, they come into our lives to, you know, to make them better. You know, certainly there was a lot more laughter and love as a result of having Ruby in our lives, for sure. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So while we're here talking about our dogs and what our dogs lead us into, without our dogs, we would never have met, would we?
No.
No.
Not at all.
So,
yeah.
And you start off, if you like, and I'll keep jumping in. But because it was another mad scheme, wasn't it? A mad dog scheme. So how did we meet? You start us off.
There was a competition on ITV this morning's A Dog for the Dales, it was called. That's it. And I was at home one day. I don't know why I was at home, but I had the TV on in the morning, very rare, and they were advertising this competition.
Mm.
And you could enter a video clip of your dog doing a trick or something. And the competition was for one dog to have a little part in one episode of Emmerdale.
Yes.
So I applied with my Bedlington Terrier Scooter, and you applied with your dog Buddy.
Yeah, my Labrador Buddy. Yeah. And we went, it was like a village hall, wasn't it, initially?
It was a village hall. Wasn't it?
I think
it was
so,
on the set of... Yeah, but we applied, and then obviously got a phone call to say we'd been shortlisted.
Yeah.
And then we had to go and do an audition.
Yeah.
So there was a few of us, and we had to go and do an audition in front of... It was like Britain's Got Talent.
Yes.
You know, you had your panel of judges, and you had to go into this village hall and do a trick.
And there was Sarah Fisher.
Whole film. Yes.
Sarah Fisher and Dominic Brunt.
And
producers, or I'm really sorry, I don't remember their name, but they're one of the producers.
No, it's a long time ago now.
But it was a lovely day because there were about, I think we were about five of us there with our dogs, and we had lunch there, didn't we? We all had fun and...
Yes, yeah, it was brilliant. And then was it the final three or something?
I think so, yeah. And then we went to, actually, the Emmerdale Village, didn't we? Down to the Emmerdale Village, up to the Emmerdale Village, and had...
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember. And we actually got to sit in the set, didn't we? They'd take you to, like... They took me and Buddy to the bed and breakfast set, and they sort of keep us in different business. Go, right, you wait there. And I remember they left us on our own, and I thought, well, I'm going to take some pictures. Then if you leave me on my own with my dog in the bed and breakfast, I'm going to take some pictures. So we did.
Yeah. And they took filming, and then they came to the house and filmed as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
And they gave Scooter a really strange voice. All the dogs were talking. They added a voice to the dogs.
Yes.
And then we got to go on this morning.
Yes.
Didn't we?
Yeah.
For the fire, it was people phoned in with their which one they wanted to win, didn't they? It was a vote. Public vote. Yeah.
That was a lovely day, wasn't it? Because we were in the green room a lot, and we had to keep nipping out and taking the dogs out for a toilet break, and then back in, and you'd have your hair or your makeup done and whatever. And
I don't think I've ever worn too much makeup.
I've
got really strange. I don't usually wear much makeup at all.
Yeah.
You're all made up for TV.
And again, I remember Dominic Brunt was there. And he loved the dogs, and he was fussing the dogs and sitting with them. And I think Jeremy Kyle's show was on, and he wanted to stay there with the dogs in the Jeremy Kyle show rather than come and film anything, didn't he?
It's funny because I travelled down on the train from County Durham down to London, and we were in the green room, and Robin Cousins came in and said, "I must say hello to Scooter. My friend saw him on the train." I've been chatting to some guy on the train. I'm not really making a fuss of Scooter. Don't say hello to anybody else. It's just like with the dogs.
The power of a dog.
It's a wonderful experience.
And actually, neither our dog. It's funny because we are still in touch with Gemma as well. It was Gemma's dog, her beagle, wasn't it, who actually got the part.
Right. Yes.
We didn't get in. But we're still all in touch. And it's lovely memories. I really think the more I think about it, it's have fun but make memories. You know, the things that you do, those fun things that are important at the time, become much more important as time passes and you don't have the dog anymore. And it's a lovely memory to look back on.
Yeah, it is. There's nothing nicer than to sort of think, do you remember when this happened? Or because you forget, don't you, sometimes, and then something reminds you, and you go, remember when that happened?
Yeah, it was a smashing day, and now I met lovely people, you and Gemma, and it was just smashing and fun and just seize the day.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You're just going to go for it. Have fun with your dog. And yeah. 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 There's someone there having a good part as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the most important thing with some of these things like that. You know, different situations are more suited to some dogs than others. And both our dogs then were very much, they were excellent, weren't they? You could almost, you could take them anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Do anything with them, with Scooter and Buddy.
Yeah.
Had a great time.
I remember when we took Mr. Dogcast and I and Buddy arrived in the foyer of this big hotel, and we were in there to go to the Emmerdale Village. We went in and it was a big foyer and bustling and busy.
Yeah.
And I got Buddy's dog bed with me. Just put it down on the floor because I couldn't manage to keep everything in my hands. And Mr. Dogcast went and checked in. And I looked down and Buddy's like, OK, we're sleeping here. And he's on his bed, settled, like, OK, we're sleeping. It's a bit busy, but it's fine. And he was so chilled. He was just like, yeah, OK, I'll sleep here.
They were so good, though. I would never have thought of taking a dog down to London on the train and staying in a hotel. But Scooter he dealt with it so well. Yeah. And I think we must have been in the same hotel.
Yes.
I had a big foyer. But I remember, like, the next morning or something, I think we were waiting for cars to come and pick us up or something. He was sat there, and somebody on holiday asked if they could take his picture. And I said, yeah, fine. So he's just sat there in the foyer. And then a whole load of other people, it must have been part of like a big group, all come out from behind the pillar, and they were all taking photos as well. I thought, we're doing paparazzi. He's enjoying this, being famous.
Yeah. Buddy loved the attention. It was happy days. Yeah.
Happy days. Good memories.
Good
memories indeed. And Sarah and I were so lucky to have Buddy and Scooter in our lives and to make such good friends through our dogs. It's genuinely been a joy to be part of the Tripod Superdog project. Huge thanks to Sarah for asking me to collaborate with her. All the links are on the Dogcast Radio site at dogcastradio.com. And if you have a tripod dog or you know someone with a three-legged dog, do contact me or put them in touch with me. I'd love to share their story.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
More uplifting, inspirational content now as we hear from Susanna Chalmers, who is the assistant manager of the Great Britain Senior Agility World Championship team. And as you hear, this is a historic moment. So without further ado, let's hear from Sue.
So for years and years, GB has sent agility teams to the World Championships, a junior team and an adult team. And we decided that it would be a great idea if we actually sent a senior team, because we've got lots of very good senior handlers in the country, but that probably haven't got the speed that the younger handlers have got, but all the skill set. So we spoke to the Kennel Club, and Kennel Club agreed that we could actually do that. So Jackie Gardner, who is the team manager, I'm the assistant team manager.
Yeah.
Put together a tryout day where we invited people to apply to try out, and we sat and watched, crikey, over 100 senior handlers.
Wow.
Compete on some of the courses that had been set, and we drew up a short list of people and then named our teams, which we have a team of 55 to 65 year olds, and that's in all heights, small, medium, intermediate and large.
Mm-hmm.
And then a team of handlers who are over 65, also small, medium, intermediate and large.
Yeah.
And we go to Belgium, and it's the first time in history that a senior team, well, the senior world championships are going to be run. So there are something like, I'm not sure exactly, but there are over 35 countries competing.
Wow. That is going to be fantastic. Such a big agility party, that. Yes.
Oh, yes. It's a huge event. So the actual event takes place from the 18th to the 21st of July. But we go 2 days earlier because we have to do things like official vet checks, opening ceremony, team practices, so that we're ready to start competing on the Friday.
That's what
we're doing, and it's run in conjunction alongside the Junior World Championships as well, which were selected a long time ago, really, for the GB.
Yeah.
But this is the first time in history that senior world championships have been run.
Yeah. That's so exciting to be part of, isn't it?
It's incredible. Yes. I mean, I toyed with the sort of idea of maybe trying out for the team. But when sort of Jackie asked me, I could do with some help, really. I just thought maybe for a change, it would be quite nice to take on a managerial role instead of running around like a headless chicken. So that's what I'm doing this time. And already I've got my championships coming up in September. So I've already got something in the bag that I'll be doing with Aaron. And so this is a good opportunity to I think it will be so exciting, especially being involved with the first one ever to be run.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. So it's run sort of exactly as agility, you know, sort of younger agility is run, if you like, but it's the handlers are a little bit older. And can we also clarify when you talk about the sizes, you know, the small, medium, large, and we're talking about the dogs, aren't we? Not the handlers.
The dog size. Yes. So small dogs are under 30 centimeters, under 35 centimeters. And then you have medium, intermediate and large. And the handlers category, you've got the 55 to 65 year old category and then the over 65 category.
Yeah.
And we've got some incredible dogs and handlers in this country. There'll be an individual event and there'll also be a team event. So the teams have already been selected that we will run. And we're hoping to come back with a few medals.
Yeah, exactly. Everything.
Or at least show the rest of the world that once you're 55, it doesn't mean to say that you need just to sit down and put some slippers on. You can actually still compete at the top.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, for people that haven't tried agility, I have tried agility. I haven't done very well at it at all. But oh my goodness, I expected it to be physically difficult, but it just wiped me out mentally as well. It's a real all-round workout, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Because, I mean, obviously the first thing you need to do is be able to memorize the course, which the higher grades you go up. And obviously the World Championships will be the pinnacle of testing courses. So to memorize that and then to steer your dog around correctly and be able to complete the round within the course time, because there's a set time in the fastest time, clear on all the obstacles without being eliminated. Is difficult, and but this is what we do day in, day out. So I suppose we're quite used to it now.
Yeah,
it'll be very, very exciting. I dare say there'll be a live link at some time, so it'll be televised. So I'll let you know what that is, and you can have a look.
Excellent.
We've all been issued yesterday with our team kit, which is incredible. Really lovely. We've got lots of. We've had some amazing sponsors this time that have enabled us to be able to go.
Yeah.
But I'm just really chuffed to be in at the beginning, if you know what I mean. It's historical, really, because it's never been done before.
Yeah, excellent. Now, and not content with one world championship event, as you say, you're off to another one. It's September, so tell us about that.
So I'm off to the International Mixed Breed and Para Agility. I am a para athlete due to certain disabilities that I have. That mean I can still complete and run a course with my dog, but I do have issues in some areas, such as possibly turns and stuff like that and speed. So every year they hold the Para Agility World Championships. This year it's in Beja in Portugal. Once again, held over 3 days. The international mixed breed side of it is a team and individual event. The para side is basically an individual event.
Hmm.
Last year was Aaron and I's first attempt. And we did rather well, actually, in the Netherlands. We actually won 2 bronze medals and, due to the point system, ended up as reserve world champions.
Wow. So,
I know.
Congratulations. I mean, brilliant.
I don't think it'll ever be that exciting again, because... Yeah. It'll be a difficult act to follow, but we'll do our best.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. I mean, congratulations. You're amazing. And Aaron is amazing. And mentioning Aaron, who is your beloved dog that you run with, that you're a team with. Now, for anybody picturing a border collie, they'd be wrong, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
So tell us about Aaron.
So he's very, very big for Papillon. He's at the top end of... Well, he's above breed standard anyway, and he's at the top end of of running in small in this country, because he's 34 centimetres and the limit's 35.
Wow.
So he's only just into the small category. So he is substantial for a Papillon. And yes, he's very trainable. He's very biddable. He loves to work. His highlight of his day is training. So yes, I suppose he's very similar in a lot of ways to the brain of a border collie. Although he doesn't herd sheep. I've not seen him do that.
You just haven't let him try yet.
But that's true. Yes, he probably would be good at that as well. I think he's good at everything. He's just one of those.
Yeah. He could probably herd sheep, cows, goats, the lot.
Yeah. I think he probably could. Yeah.
Yeah. Bless him. It's amazing. I mean, it's so good what you're doing. And you've always championed, you've ended up championing sort of unlikely causes in a way, because with Marsha, your other agility dog, I mean, again, not a border collie. A pug.
No.
A pug.
So, no, I told somebody that yesterday, actually, at the team training day, and they were absolutely flabbergasted. And they said, but why would you do agility with a pug? And I said, why not?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why not?
Yeah.
You know, if you look, not all dogs have the potential, but I saw potential in her and she enjoyed it. And as long as you're realistic as to where you're going to get, why not? You know, it was great fun for her. It was, she's retired now. She's 10 years old, but I think that she's had a super life, really.
Yeah.
As to where she could have come from. She was also a rescue, which would have meant that we really had not much of an idea of, you know, what she'd have gone on to do. But yes, thoroughly enjoyed it. That gave me the agility bug with Marsha.
Yeah.
But yes, when it came to sort of doing agility again, I decided to jump ship, if you like, and go for a different breed.
Oh.
And yeah, I'm glad I did, because Papillons, they're incredibly smart, very clever, very talented, and joyous breed, really.
Yeah, they're amazing, aren't they? I mean, full disclosure, Aaron's daughter is Diamond. One of Aaron's daughters is Diamond. So my puppy. So and we're going through the puppy phase with them, and they're a challenging lot as puppies, aren't they? So we'll
are challenging. I decided, because Aaron was such a superstar, to breed a litter with him earlier this year, and I kept one, Angus. The devil child, and Julie had Diamond, who was the sweeter one in the litter that we thought would probably be the quieter one.
It's still a little monkey. Oh my goodness! I mean, if she's the quiet,
that the whole litter is completely bonkers.
Yeah, yeah. If she's the quieter one, goodness help the rest of you, because she's full on.
Yeah, Julie and I have been discussing hair tearing out days, really, but. Yes, they are hard work, but I think there is light definitely at the end of my tunnel.
Yeah,
it's coming, and I'm hopefully we will end up with incredible dogs, because they've got incredible genes.
Yes,
so they should be.
Yeah,
But would I do it again? Possibly not. I think Aaron's days of fathering another litter are probably over.
Yes, he can concentrate on his agility career now.
I think so. I think it might be a wise idea. Don't think the world's ready for any more of these little dynamos, do you?
No. Oh, absolutely not. No. I'm not sure they're ready for the four that are nearly ready to go out into the world, but there you go. But I mean, I think that's really important to say. We've had dogs before. We have really struggled with these puppies. And I think puppyhood, you forget how horrible puppyhood that time. It's lovely, but it's horrible. So for anybody struggling with a puppy,
it is not what people think.
No.
Everyone it goes into it, and me included, and I'm a dog person, I've got six dogs.
Yeah.
So I was also, I can't wait for puppy cuddles. I can't wait for, the puppy breath and stuff like that. Well, I've had that. Not so much the cuddle side, but I've had plenty of sleepless nights, hair pulling, biting, various other issues, and my puppy's been hard work, and I know Diamond has as well.
Oh gosh, so, absolutely, very very hard work. I've definitely had that, several of the "what have I done" moment, Oh gosh,
Yeah. I'm not quite sure why, as I say, because Aaron as a puppy was just delightful. He was so well behaved and so good and quiet, and he was absolute and intelligent as well. So he was he was everything that his son's not.
Oh, bless him. Yeah.
Well, no, his son is very intelligent, but yes, probably a bit too intelligent.
Yeah. We all think we want an intelligent dog. And then you get one, you go, oh, my goodness, you're more intelligent than me. You're outclassing me.
Yes.
But I do. Yes. See, I do wonder, and I hate to suggest this, but I wonder if you're looking back with rose-tinted glasses, and you obviously you're telling me you're not. But when I was talking to my family about Buddy, and so saying, but Buddy was perfect from the word go, and Buddy didn't do this, and Buddy didn't do that, and, you know, and they went, he did. And they reminded me of some of the, you know, and when I say dreadful, just being ordinary puppy. When Buddy was a
maybe
puppy,
that's
he was
what
a swine.
Maybe it's like childbirth. Maybe yes, like in a few months' time, you'll say something to me about Diamond, and I'll say, well, Angus has never done that.
Yes, I think so.
And meanwhile, he's done everything and more. Yeah. So yeah. It's hard to say. Aaron had his moments, and I do remember of being full on, but he was also very well behaved.
Yeah.
And he certainly didn't draw blood. I mean, Angus has had me nearly in tears quite a few times.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
me
he
too.
Can be quite
yeah.
savage. But I'm hoping that, yeah, there's light at the end of
yes,
the tunnel.
Yes, yeah. It's probably Aaron driving the train towards you, though. Not Aaron, sorry. Angus driving the train towards you.
Yes.
That light.
Yes.
But, yeah.
The hardest, honestly, he's been the hardest puppy that I've
yes.
ever had.
Yeah, yeah, ditto.
Without
Same
doubt.
Yeah, yeah. So, but, you know, if they're harder as a puppy, they're going to be even better as a dog. And I do think you've got to put that work in with them. You know, if you have a puppy, you've got to put the work in with them to get them, you know, help them become the dog they have the potential to be. I mean, and also saying that, you've done so brilliantly at agility, and obviously you're competing at a world level, and your dogs are athletes, and it's a challenge. I know you sort of you have to meet their needs every day, but if someone's sitting there, whether they've got a pug or a Papillon or whatever they've got, agility, any dog sport, is worth having a go. We'll talk about agility because that's your specialism. But I
agree with that. There's some dogs that cannot, for various reasons, perform at agility, whether that's the breed issue or whether that's from some sort of inability to be able to, you know, maybe with a lameness or something like that, or something that says that they can't perform. But there are lots of other dog sports, and I am a firm believer in all dogs need mental stimulation.
Yes. Definitely.
Whether that's scent work, whether that's hoopers, man trailing, barn hunt, all these new things that are coming into the UK now, if physically they can't run and jump jumps, there are lots of other things that they can do. And I think it's just so beneficial. You know, you get a much more sort of focused, rounded dog that enjoys what they do. It makes them use their brain. Which mental exhaustion is more tiring for a dog than physical exhaustion, really.
Definitely.
So absolutely. I'm a firm believer in that. I mean, I'm also a firm believer in from the get-go. I mean, Angus is, well, what are our puppies now? How old are they? Are they 4 months yet? Not quite, are they?
I think they're coming up to, because it was the 6th of March, so March, April.
Right,
March.
So yeah, coming up to 4 months old.
Yeah.
Angus already is doing his Good Citizen Puppy Foundation course, which is a 6-week course.
Excellent.
Every Wednesday night.
Yeah.
When I take him on his own in the car for an hour, and he in a mixed class, and he has to learn to adapt, behave appropriately, go through the exercises, because those things are very important at this age.
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm also, you know, a real believer in that they're never too young to start getting them used to following commands and doing things, even from a showing point of view. If you want to show, you know, you've got ring craft and things like that, all beneficial to a puppy, because you're then mixing in an environment with lots of stimulation and lots of other dogs, and they need to learn to work through that. So there's something for everybody, really.
Yeah, absolutely. For every dog, for every handler, for every team.
Yeah.
And it's, and I always think that we're not all great competitors and athletes like you, because I always think that competing gives you one chance to fail, whereas training gives you many chances to succeed. So I really prefer the training bit to the competing.
Training bit. And some people, you know, with agility, they don't compete. Some people only go to a weekly class. But there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
It's really good fun. You know, you're doing something outside with other like-minded people.
Yeah.
The dogs absolutely love it. I mean, even at a very basic level, dogs love agility. There are not many that I know that dislike it.
Yeah.
So find a little club, and if it's not something that you want to do from a, you know, a competing point of view, you can just do agility for fun.
Yeah.
Or have some stuff in the garden that, that you use. You know, I've got things in my garden at home that I use every day, even with Aaron, who competes at world championship level. So there are still things I've got here that I will train on a daily basis.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's good for them.
Yeah. Well, we all have hobbies, don't we? You sit down and you read or you knit or you do a Sudoku or a crossword or whatever, or watch television, you know. But we all have our hobbies. Yeah. Maybe our dogs need hobbies too.
They certainly need something to think about and something that they enjoy doing. I am a believer in that. I mean, Marsha absolutely loved her agility. From a dog point of view, a pug's not particularly built for agility. Mm-hmm. You know, there were lots of times that I wouldn't compete with her because the weather would be too hot. She doesn't do particularly very well in heat. But the stuff that I did do, she absolutely loved it. There was never a time that I thought, I'm doing this for me. Yeah. I was doing it for her because she just loved it.
Yeah.
And you get the bug then, you know, once you become sort of quite good at it and you see the work that you've put in, and it is only the work that you put in that produces a dog that can do a set of 12 weaves or a seesaw or stuff like that, it's quite a reward.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I trained Aaron from when he was 5 months old all the way through. So, I have the trainers that I go to who are fantastic, but all the groundwork really I put in myself, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's a real high, I think, when you work as a team with your dog. That's a real high, isn't it? Yeah.
Do you know, it was funny because I had a bit of a health scare last year and I couldn't compete for quite a few months. So a friend of mine that I train with, I wanted Aaron to continue working, and so I asked her if she would train him for me, if I took him every week, that she would still run him at club, to which she did, and he was great and absolutely loved working for her and one thing another. And I'd qualified him earlier on in the year for a championship that was in November, and I said, if I can change the name of the handler to you, would you run him in these finals? So she said, yeah, no problem. And they were doing really, really well at club. Mm. Anyway, so I drove him there to the championships. He left the start line and ran out of the ring.
Oh.
So when you're talking about relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
Aaron would love to have fun with somebody at club level.
Yeah.
But knew the difference when it was a competition.
Bless him.
And obviously thought, he only wants to run with me.
Yeah.
And since I've been back running him, he's back to normal again now. He's going brilliantly.
Oh, bless him.
But he won't compete with anybody else. He refuses point blank.
Yeah. Oh, bless him. Oh.
So that's the connection there, which was, at the time, it was a bit frustrating. Aaron, move, go back in. He's like, nope, I'm not going. Mm. If you're not in there, I'm not going.
Yeah.
And we tried another couple of times after that at a smaller show, just to see whether the atmosphere had sort of got to him a bit. He did exactly the same.
Wow. Yeah.
He ran out. At the start, she called him and he just ran out the ring to me.
Wow. That's incredible. He's a dog with opinions, isn't he? This is where our puppies get it from.
Sadly, it looks that way. Yeah. Yes. But in a way, it was a bit upsetting. But in a way, it was quite nice that he'll only work for me.
Yeah. You know?
And in fact, my trainer, Jo Gleed, who's on the GB team, she has about four or five in the top class competitions, and she said to me, well, none of mine would run for anybody else. So it is a thing.
Yeah.
It is the connection that you get that is very personal to you and your dog.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, the more training and time you spend with them and the more you work on that bond, whatever it is you're doing, the stronger it gets, and the more they do love you. I do think they love you. Yeah, I think it's me. And that's
Aaron is
happen.
A funny bunny. He's not a lap dog. He's not a licky dog. He's not a particularly waggy tail dog. He will always be with me. But if I go to pick him up or if I get too close to him, he will actually growl at me. But he adores me in his way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
From the bottom of his heart.
Yeah.
But in his way.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is not, he doesn't want me wrapping my arms around him and covering him with kisses. That's his worst nightmare.
Oh, bless him. But they do all have their own personalities. I remember with Buddy and Star. Buddy was a big black Labrador, Star's a little white Bichon Frise. And people would always think, who met them, that Star was going to be the cuter, sort of softer option to say hello to or anything like that. Actually, Buddy was the softest, daftest, didn't have a nasty bone in his body, would do anything, always wanted to be glued to your side, wanted to be with you, that. But Star, she was lovely, she was smashing, but she would often go, right, I've had enough of you guys, I'm going to go and sleep in the bedroom for a bit. And she'd take herself off and she needed space. And, you know, okay, sometimes she did want to go on your lap, but sometimes she was like, no, I need my space, I need to go away, I need to be by myself. And
yeah,
we have to listen to them and give them the space to do that, don't we, to be themselves.
Yes. I'm very much with Aaron now. I appreciate that he needs his downtime.
Yeah.
Although we have six dogs, he likes to sleep in my room, not on my bed. He will never, ever go on my bed. It's just, he could if he wanted to.
Yeah.
But that would be too close for him. Aww. He's got his raised bed at the side of mine and we have our own time in there and that's his downtime.
Yeah.
And whenever I go upstairs, he will be straight on my heels because he feels happy there. And so you need to feed that, you know.
Yeah.
And let them do what they want to do.
Yeah, definitely.
And so... yeah, he is a funny bunny in lots of ways, but I know him. So
yeah,
that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. They're all individuals, just like people are all individuals.
They
dogs are all individuals. Absolutely. Absolutely.
They are.
I wish you lots and lots of luck for both world championships you're involved in this year. Wow, you're incredible. You are inspiring. I have to say that before we finish. You're just amazing. You just show me that whatever challenges you have in life, you know, whether that's health or whatever that is, just keep going. You are inspirational.
You have to do that. I mean, I think, yeah, I've always been very goal driven. If somebody tells me you won't be able to do that, I'm like, I'll try and find a way.
Yeah.
And I think that comes a lot from living in Africa for so many years.
Mm.
Because often things were difficult there, or things were difficult to obtain or get done.
Yeah.
And so lots you would think that's impossible, but the challenge to me would be to find a way to do that.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I've adopted my whole life, really. And I won't change from that, you know? Yeah. So yeah. I just hope that, yeah, I mean, last year we went to the Netherlands hoping that we would just get round one of the courses. To get two bronze medals and reserve world champion was more than I could ever have dreamt would happen.
Yeah.
This year, yeah, I mean, I'm hoping once again just to get round. But I suppose in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, if I don't do very well, you know, would that knock my confidence? Not really, because you do it because of your relationship with your dog.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You do it to have that moment and to be representing your country on the world stage. I mean, what's better than that?
You know, there's really not much that is better than that. We have links on the Dogcast Radio site to the page on the Kennel Club site devoted to the Senior Agility World Championships and to their Facebook page too. You can hear Sue talking about how Aaron came into her life in episode 263 of Dogcast Radio. And it's funny, but when Sue was telling me about Aaron in that interview, he sounded so amazing. I started thinking, I want a Papillon. To be honest, I do fall a little in love with every dog we feature on Dogcast Radio, so I wasn't really surprised. And I never dreamed that I would one day be living with not only a Papillon, but one of Aaron's puppies. As you probably gathered, Aaron's puppies, and there are four of them in all, they have been a challenge to raise. They're just a lot. They're very full on, with lots of attitude and energy and brain and just a lot. I'm recording our experiences as we go along with Diamond, and I'm going to bring you that in one podcast or maybe a series of podcasts. We'll see. But for now, good luck to Sue and Aaron in all they do. If you cross a Newfoundland with a Basset Hound, you get a Newfound Asset Hound, a dog for financial advisors. Although this is Dogcast Radio, we're going to focus on a cat now. A kitten, in fact. I'm talking to Deborah Westgate-Silver about the real-life story behind her children's book, Daisy's Near Catastrophe. And although the cat-a-list, see what I did there? For this story is feline. It's a very dog-centric story, both in fact and fiction.
Yes, so Daisy's Near Catastrophe is the story of a lost kitten finding her way home and her way back to her dog sibling named Bear. But she's getting a little bit of help on the way from another dog who's trained to find missing pets. And it's based on a true story.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, let's jump in. That's my instinct. Let's jump into the true story first, because I love this. I love this. So your nephew, Charlie.
Yes. So it's based on my nephew, Charlie's kitten. And Daisy is a kitten who really can open doors. She can open the doors that have the type of handle that's a lever.
Yes.
And so she pounces on it and uses her weight to open the door. And she does this at home to get into the pantry closet with the treat bags, with the treats in it.
Yeah.
And she gets treats for herself and her dog siblings, one of whom is named Bear.
Oh, bless. And there's proof right there that reward-based training works, because the reward, nobody taught her to open the door, but the reward, the treats are there, and that's enough, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So the family went on vacation, our entire family. So it was me, my sisters, our husbands, our kids, our parents. So there was no one to watch her pets. And so she boarded them at a kennel. The dogs were older and they were used to their kennel, and their kennel didn't board cats. So Daisy went to a different kennel. And unbeknownst to my sister, there was a window at that kennel that had one of those lever handles. Mm. So the first night that she was there, Daisy slid open the door, popped out the screen, and escaped.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, this is, it's a nightmare. We have three cats, and as are not gifted in this way, they don't open doors. Although I have seen a friend's cat do exactly that, sort of jump and hang and swing and do it. Yeah, I've seen that. But we chose a cattery that the lady there is just as paranoid as we are. And that's a good thing. I'm not saying paranoid in a negative way. You know, you've got to think, what can go wrong here? How can I stop it going wrong? So we do a two-door system at home. She does a two-door system. Having said that, accidents happen, things go wrong, you know, and it's horrific when it does go wrong, and it can be catastrophic, can't it? So, wow. So you're on holiday and you all got the news that poor Daisy's gone?
Exactly. Yes. So, of course, my sister was, just couldn't even wrap her head around the whole thing.
Yeah.
The kennel, they felt terrible. And so they immediately hired this canine tracker, so a dog trained to find missing pets. And I just thought that was fascinating. I'd never heard of it before. I know dogs perform different services, but I'd never heard of finding missing pets. And how would they find the pets without scaring them deeper into hiding? And I thought the whole thing was fascinating. And right away, I thought, you know, this is a children's book, but of course I can never write it unless there's a happy ending here.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's how it started. I can lead you through the whole rescue process.
Yeah, that would be lovely. Actually, that would be lovely because, you know, you have this idea, this image of, you know, the tracker dog leading the handler to the kitten, going, the kitten's here. It's over here, Mom. You know, they scoop the kitten up. Everything's happening. It's not how it works in real life, is it?
It's not. And it really, it was fascinating. So the dog that they hired, is named Samantha, and she's a German Shepherd. And her handler, I'm sorry, the German Shepherd's name is Hopper, and her handler is named Samantha. And so in the book, the rescue efforts are shown in the illustrations. But how it really happened is when Sam and Hopper arrived at the kennel, Hopper was given one of Daisy's blankets so he could learn her scent. And then she was brought to the window that she escaped from, and they began to track her. So she is so incredibly well-trained that she just, her behavior lets her handler know when she detects the missing pet, and she just sits and doesn't do anything else to prevent the other, the missing animal from getting scared and going deeper into hiding.
It's amazing. It's do they call it a pass? I don't know much about it, but it's a passive alert. It's kind of, I'm sitting and I'm, I think that it's very important they don't interact.
So, you know, she sat and she wouldn't move, and that let Sam know that Daisy was close. So she wasn't too far from the kennel, but she was in a pretty densely wooded area, so they couldn't see Daisy. And so what they do at that point is they set out food and they set out a camera. So it's like a weatherproof camera that has a belt, so they can strap it and tie it around a tree or a pole.
Wow.
And they know that if the missing pet eats from that food, that they'll return there. So that she calls that, you know, developing the food source. So Daisy did eat from there, as did a huge white stray cat, a raccoon, and another dog. And so we know all this from the camera. And so what was captured on the camera, I tried to use in the storyline.
Yeah. Yeah. I tell you what, Disney needs to buy this. This is definitely a Disney story in the making. I love it.
That would be amazing.
Wouldn't it? Yeah.
So, you know, we don't know that the animals actually interacted, but we do know they were all in the same vicinity around the same time. But so the big cat and the raccoon and the dog did become characters in the story. And just like in real life, they would have spelled danger for Daisy. In the story, Big Cat is not a very good friend to Daisy, and the raccoon is just trouble. But this is, you know, obviously depicted at a child's level.
Yeah. But you see, I love that because, you know, I'll give as few spoilers as possible, but, you know, as a kitten, you would think a cat would be a good ally, wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. Are they a good ally or not? You know, you have to, I think this is a great way to talk to children about, you know, making decisions and who you think is your friend and who isn't and who is and how you assess that. Because, you know, again, you know, a good friend sometimes will tell you things you don't want to hear. So it's such a complicated thing to convey to children, but talking about it one removed from themselves, you know, talking about it from an animal's point of view, I think it's so clever.
Thank you. And I do have a full curriculum guide on my website that goes into not only literacy skill-based lessons, but those social emotional things you just mentioned about friendship and assertive communication versus passive and aggressive. And I think there's some fun things in there. Yeah, so I hope it's helpful to teachers.
I think that is wonderful. I have downloaded that. And And I think that's really good. I used to teach in a previous incarnation kind of thing. But yeah, I think it's brilliant. And something my daughter used to get on her school report a lot was withstands inappropriate peer pressure. And I loved that. And I said to them, that is what will help you survive. You know, never mind the academic stuff is important, but that withstanding the inappropriate peer pressure, that is what will help you to survive, to use the academic skills, you know. And I was really, really pleased with that. So I think that really is important. And I love this because I have this instinct to, you know, I want to write, I want to get my stories out there, but more than that, I want them to spark conversations. And, you know, you have given parents and teachers and children the tools to have some really great conversations, haven't you?
I hope that's what it leads to. And if it does, I would love to hear about it as well. So people can contact me through my website, which is DeborahWestgateSilva.com.
Smashing. Yeah, get the plug in. I will ask you that again later. But yes, get the plug in now. Definitely. Because there's some great resources on there. And, you know, smashing. So I think that's really good because more, you know, the older I get, the more I understand that story is how we make sense of the world. And I mean, over here, I don't know whether you've heard of it there, but we have the post office scandal over here. And that has rumbled on for years and years. When it was made into a drama, and it may be coincidence, but when it was made into a drama and a hard-hitting drama that you watched and you cried and you thought, oh my goodness, these poor people that have lived with this for so long. Now there's been an inquiry and now the police are getting involved. by the time this is going out, I may have to update people and say, this is what's happening with the post office business. But, you know, I do think that story is what pulls us in and how we make sense of things.
And how we see different, open us up to perspectives different from our own, and, you know, to see lands that we may never visit in our lifetime. And I do believe in the power of books and story.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I mean, for children, it's for 49-year-old children, but I think there's things that resonate in there for whoever you are. But it's, you know, there's messages about friendship, assertiveness, distinguishing fact from fiction. Those are key skills, aren't they, for anybody to have?
Yes, absolutely. And I think distinguishing, so that's one of the first lessons on that curriculum guide is, you know, how, when a story is based on a true story, and I tell this when I ask the students this, when I've read to them, does that mean it's 100% true? And they need to understand that, no, there are creative liberties taken. And how do you tell fact from fiction? And with social media and algorithms that, you know, help you to see viewpoints that are like yours and not differing ones, I just think that's so critical that kids look at things more analytically.
Yeah. Definitely. Absolutely. Absolutely. I have to say, saying that, one of the things that I and my friends, I've found that other people have done is, you know, watching The Crown about the royal family. And I'm forever looking things up. Was that true? Was that true? Was that, you know, and as you say, how do you know that you're looking at a reliable source? You know, so evaluating sources is really, really important. And as you say, ever more important as you get into an echo chamber, don't you, of voices mm-hmm. the same as your own. And you have to think, hang on, is this true? You know, sometimes I've had this in the past where the result of an election is different from what I was expecting. But everybody on social media is saying, and they weren't saying, you know, I was just being fed that. So really, really important. And your books are raising funds for trauma-impacted youth with therapy dogs. So tell me about that.
Yes. So I wanted to donate proceeds to an animal related cause. And what I decided on was to focus on organizations that help provide therapy dogs to where it's needed.
Yeah.
So there's two organizations that I'm focused on right now. I've sent a check out. After the first 24 hours when the book launched earlier this month, I sent out one check to each of these two organizations. And Brilliant. My goal is monthly to look at sales and send out other ones. But the first one is a nonprofit organization that provides grants that help initiate therapy dog programs in schools. And the other one is an organization that trains and deploys comfort animals to individuals and communities that have been impacted by crisis or disaster.
Wow.
So I feel really good about that, that I was able to send a decent sized check already to each of those. And I think that those therapy dogs do such amazing work. I worked for several years. I've worked in education for most of my life, but I was especially good with the at-risk kids, which led to a nonprofit position that I held for about 5 years, where I was working with trauma impacted kids. And so I saw what therapy animals can do for those kids. And so I've just always felt really strongly about how good they are. Yeah, and I wanted to be able to further support that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they are amazing. There is something in just the silent companionship of a dog, a cat, whatever it is, a rabbit, horse, you know, that just is there with you. There's no judgment. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to think of the words, anything like that. It's just, there is a magic, a healing magic to it, isn't there?
There is. And for these kids that have been let down so much by the adults and the people in their lives, and they don't have that lack of trust with the animals. So So sometimes that's when they let their guard down and they look and they act like kids. And it's just, I think it's amazing. It's funny because right now I write grants, and actually one of the organizations that I just spoke of actually provided a grant to the organization that I write grants for a therapy dog. And we had gone around before that to some other organizations to see how they implemented their therapy dog program. And it was just really interesting because one of the women in the group is a very high profile, you know, professional, in charge, has it all together woman. And from what I understand, therapy dogs are trained to go to the person who most needs, like that they feel the most anxiety or whatever from. And the dog went directly to her.
Wow.
And she got on the floor and she's like playing with the dog. And then, of course, we had our meeting and an hour and a half later we left. And she says, I had no idea how much I needed that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's somebody, you know, that seems to have it all together. That's not one of these kids or young adults that are struggling and kind of imprisoned by their the trauma that they're working on. So I really do think it's amazing.
Yeah. But isn't that lovely that we see different things? You know, we see a together person who's groomed and, you know, and we're a little bit intimidated or we're, you know, we're whatever, or we assume, well, they're okay. But the dog sees something entirely different and also isn't afraid to go and sort of, you know, cuddle up or whatever it is. You know, I think that thing we just need to, if it's just saying to each other, you're okay, you know, and just checking in with each other, which we can't do in the same way that the dog does. But that's lovely. That's so lovely that the dog just sees that. And as you say, the lady herself said, I didn't know I needed that. And you do sometimes feel that, don't you?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, bless. So Daisy's family now, have they changed all their door handles?
They have. And actually, that is one of the last illustrations in the book, is the father's putting locks on the windows.
Yeah.
But I didn't get to the part where they set up the trap.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. We'll.
Yes. They had set up. Let me see. We talked about the setting up the food source. And so once Daisy was on camera eating from the food source, they set up the trap. And like a lot of kittens or cats, Daisy doesn't like her crate. And so they thought she would recognize the trap and stay away from it. And so they put the food near the trap instead of inside of it to get Daisy kind of acclimated to seeing it. And then they moved it closer. And so meanwhile, you know, the trap captured a raccoon, which had to be released, and then the trap reset. And so that part is in the story. Now, at this point, the family's back from vacation. Daisy's still missing. And my sister and nephew and dog and their dog Bear are walking the area too, hoping that Daisy will get their scent and come out of hiding. And there's one illustration in the book that I really like. I think it's fun because it shows a bird's eye view of the area. And so, you know, that Hopper and Sam are setting a trap in one area. You see my nephew and his mom and Bear walking in another area. And Daisy and Big Cat are in still another area. And Daisy thinks she smells Bear, but she just kind of thinks she's imagining him because she misses him so much. And their paths are in different colors, so kids can follow their steps. And, you know, Daisy thinks she's imagining Bear, but the reader knows, no, they're really close right now. So I like that. I love that illustration. I think it's kind of fun. And so then a big storm was forecast, and you know, my sister put my nephew's sweatshirt in the trap. She put Bear's blanket in the trap, again hoping the scent would draw her closer. She put Daisy's favorite toys outside the trap, and the night of the storm, Daisy walked into the trap.
Wow.
So Sam's phone got an alert immediately as soon as that trap door closed. They checked the camera. They saw it was Daisy, and they went and got her. It was 23 days that she was missing.
Wow.
Before she was reunited with her family.
Wow. I tell you what, she's not only clever enough to open doors, she's got spectacular timing. That's perfect. For this Disney film, that's the perfect timing.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, wow, that's incredible. Well, I to go back to the illustrations, I know the illustration you're talking about with the paths, that has got some great, you can talk about a lot of geographical concepts with children from that, you know, and maps and that, you know, to go off on a different tangent, that's really interesting. But the illustrations are, they bring a whole other aspect to the book, don't they? They're lovely.
I was thrilled with the illustrations. And, you know, we really, Joris Handuko and I, we really communicated about how to show the other side of the story, because, of course, Daisy doesn't know she's being rescued.
No.
So that's not in the text of the story. It's in the illustrations, which I think is another great lesson for kids, just, you know, in this world where everything is so fast, and to really take time to look at the illustration and see that there's another story going on behind the story.
Yeah, yeah. And never give up hope, because you don't know, someone's coming never to rescue you.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And partly she helps herself too.
Yes, she does.
But, you know, one of the things when I was writing the story, I just kept trying to say, you know, can I make Hopper, the rescue dog, more of a character in the story as opposed to in the illustrations? Because he really is the hero of the story, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I couldn't figure out a way to do it that wasn't contrived or that still kept the story as true as I could make it be. And then, you know, I thought about it and I really like the idea that there's somebody helping Daisy and Daisy has no idea about that. Yeah. Because, I mean, that is true in life so often, right? We might have somebody advocating for us that we don't know about. And I just thought that that's another great message I was hoping would shine through for kids.
Yeah, definitely. But also, I think you need to talk to Sam, to Samantha, and get some more Harper stories, and more books will just spring forth, yes. I think.
It could be a series, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, let me just say this too. If for teachers that do want to use it in the classroom or that see the curriculum guide on my website, if they reach out to me, Samantha and I did a video. It's a 6 or 7 minute video, so it's longer than the one that is on YouTube now. I'm keeping this one private for teachers, but I'm happy to share the link so that students can meet the real Hopper and hear firsthand about those rescue efforts. So she shows the tools that they use, and I think it's really I like the story because I thought it was a fun story, but then I thought it had opened up a whole new world of what dogs can do.
Yes.
And, you know, so many kids think, oh, I would love to be a veterinarian when I grow up, but they don't know that there's all these other jobs that involve animals. And I just think it's really good information that can be helpful and kind of open perspectives.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree. And there's more jobs coming along every day, aren't there, that you can do. So, you know, that's great. You've got to keep them up to date. Yeah. I love your enthusiasm for it. And it is a great story. But I love the fact that, you know, you write it and then you see more and more angles to it and more that, you know, children can take from it or parents can take from it and how useful it can be in school. And I'd love, like you say, I'd love to hear some feedback about how children are taking it and running with it, because they always... Well, often the children actually take it in a different way than you'd thought of, and that's really great, that creativeness.
That's true, and that's funny because I read the story to a second grade classroom before the final version went to the graphic designer, because I wanted to make sure that it was really clear what that story behind the story. And they actually gave me a couple pieces of feedback that I changed one of the illustrations I had Joris change one of the illustrations in the story based on something they said. And then I changed something in the curriculum guide. And what they came back with, they were convinced that a kennel was where bad animals went.
Oh.
And I think that's from these TV shows where they retrain the dogs and the animals, and they didn't know that sometimes people board an animal, a pet at a kennel while they're on vacation and with full intentions of bringing back the pet that they love, you know?
Yeah.
So, so they added, Yaris added, there's some vacation pamphlets on the kitchen counter.
Yeah.
That wasn't in the original illustration. So he added that, and we added some other things to make it clearer that, you know, Daisy was coming home again. She was a very loved pet, even though she got into the treat closet.
Oh, bless. Because that's interesting, though, because the dog catcher, you know, he's often the baddie, aren't they? In a cartoon or a movie, or whatever. You know, the dog catcher or the dog warden or whatever you want to call them, they're the baddie. They're out to get the dog in some way.
Yeah.
So that's another great talking point. Yeah. Excellent.
That's a good point. It is. Yes.
Yeah. Do you know what we could come up with? I think we could come up with, you know, a whole series here today from the point of view of Harper and the point of view from the dog and the kennels or the dog warden. I think we could. We need to have another chat. Oh, it's been really good talking to you. I've always got one eye on the time. So is there anything else that you'd like to say that we haven't got to yet?
I don't think so. I just, you know, if people want more information on the book or on to take a look at the curriculum guide, it is available on my website, which is DeborahWestgateSilva.com. And there's literacy-based activities, social-emotional learning activities, and then there's also a list of services that dogs perform if students want to do additional research. So there's everything from police dogs to allergy detection dogs and seizure response dogs to therapy dogs, which, again, that's what I'm supporting through the proceeds of this book is organizations focused on therapy dogs. And the book's Daisy Near Catastrophe, it's available on Amazon or it can be ordered through a local independent bookstore.
You won't need to employ a sniffer dog to search out the links you need to find out more about Deb, because they are, as ever, on the Dogcast Radio site at dogcastradio.com. If Disney don't buy the rights to this story, I'm really going to be disappointed. But I am very happy that Daisy was found safe and sound in the nick of time. Have you ever used the services of a sniffer or detection dog? Maybe you and your dog have helped sniff out a lost pet or person. If so, I'd love to hear from you. If you cross a collie with a Lhasa Apso, you get a Calapso, a dog that folds up for easy transport. I'm going to speak now to Sue Williams and Dawn Ashley about Tuck's Law. I'll leave them to explain what Tuck's Law is, but I just wanted to say that this is an important and upsetting subject, but one which potentially could touch any pet owner, and one we can all mobilise and do something about. But honestly, prepare to have your minds blown and potentially your illusions shattered. One more warning just to prepare you. Sue does have a bee in the car with her at one point, but we stop at nothing and no danger to bring you the big issues here at Dogcast Radio. First of all, who was Tuck?
Tuck was a Myrotic shepherd. He was found on the streets of Romania when he was 5 weeks old. He was abandoned, so he was on his own. The lady who found him, Dawn and I were both friends with, through adopting our own dogs. We adopted ours through her too. And we were both volunteers for the rescue. She took him into foster, and the lady that took him in kept him for 5 months and basically, well, till he was 5 months old, and kept him, taught him basically everything he needed to know to be a dog. She socialized him, you know, trained him as best she could, just little things, teaching him how to climb stairs and, you know, be around other dogs. When he was 5 months old, he was put up for adoption. The rescue do give rescue back up here in the UK. So he, somebody applied for him. They were home checked. He came over. He was just amazing. He was the most beautiful dog. At this stage, obviously, he was growing into a reasonably big sized dog. Myrotic shepherds, I don't know if you're aware of them, are, they can be huge when they're fully grown, and they are a guardian breed dog. And he was wonderful. Everybody that met him that we've spoken to have said that he was just the most wonderful character. He was gentle, beautiful, obviously, to look at. And, yeah, unfortunately, he never reached adulthood and he was killed at 16 months of age.
Oh my goodness. So what on earth happened? Because it was such a good start. You know, well, it was a potentially bad start, but he was rescued from that and he was given this, you know, a much better, the hope of a much better life. So what on earth happened?
Yeah, I mean, he went to a lady who had experience with large breed dogs. She had him till the, I think he was a year, I'm trying to think when he came over. He came over, he was about 14 months, I think. And basically she said that she, everything that she had said, you could argue was, I don't want to say wrong because it wasn't, she, you know, but basically his adoption went wrong. She didn't keep him and she did the right thing. She contacted the rescue. They arranged for the rescue backup to be put in place. He went to a breed specific rescue here in the UK. They were taken, rather than just rehome him, he went to them for assessment.
Hmm.
While he was there, the ladies confirmed to Dawn and myself personally, he didn't put a paw wrong. He was wonderful. He got on with all the dogs. He got on with the humans. He was just brilliant. He was wonderful to the point that they actually were going to keep him. And then they decided that they had to let him go because if they kept him, they wouldn't be able to help any others. It was basically, it's like a lot of fosters and you know, rescues and stuff everywhere. Every dog they keep takes up a space that they could potentially help another one, and then they move them on and then another one.
Yeah.
So he was then put up for adoption after his assessment was complete. There were no real stipulations other than the fact that his breed dictated that he needed a lot of space. He needed a lot of land. He couldn't, you know, he needed a property where he had the room to not only be the breed that he was, but you know, at the end of the day, he was a big dog. He was a young dog and he needed training, he needed understanding, and he needed to be able to have the room to be what he, you know, was born to be, basically.
Yeah.
But there was an adoption offer for him. The person who took him actually had another dog of the same breed. We weren't involved in that. That was obviously through the breed specific rescue. And cut long story short, when that went wrong, he ended up in a charity who were aware that he had rescue backup. They were aware that the person who had rescued him would also take him back. And instead, they killed him.
Oh,
and to this day, we don't know why.
No, no, that's heartbreaking. No. I mean, it's just because there's no coming back from that. You can't address that. They can't put it right.
No, and the thing is, we are aware, you know, the rescue's rescue backup details were on his microchip, and Dawn and I didn't know until this happened that vets didn't need to scan to check for it. You know, you ask any rescue who puts their details on their dog's microchips or the cat's microchips, they would do it on the basis that, you know, they are there to be contacted if that animal is ever in a vulnerable position.
Yeah.
There is nothing to say that would be ignored. That it was a shock, and that's what led us to start what we're doing now.
Yeah, you see, this is horrific. It really is. I feel so strongly about this. This is horrific because we have to microchip our dogs and our cats, and we're sold that is a safety net. Should they get lost, whatever happens, you know, whatever situation they find themselves in, they can be scanned. They will find their way back to you. It's a safety net. It will get them back to you. And you are the owner of the microchip at the very least. So you should be contacted. And then it doesn't happen like this. And I think every single dog owner, cat owner, potentially pet owner should be concerned about this, because this could happen to anybody's dog, couldn't it?
Yes, I mean, that is actually what we found so shocking, and that's why we decided that we would put the petition together. And it was about, I think that obviously it had happened to Tuck, and it took about a year before Sue and I decided that actually we were going to do something about it by putting in a petition. But what we didn't realise at the time was that Tuck wouldn't be the only dog that it had happened to. So we knew that there was a gap and there was a failure in the microchip system, but what we didn't realize was that it extended not only to the rescues that were doing the rescue backup, and that was actually obviously being ignored by the vet profession because they weren't scanning for it, and also the fact that it was affecting pets as well. owned pets.
Yeah.
Because we were then sort of made aware of cats and also dogs as well, who were taken into vets by, we're saying the case of the cat was just lifted off the street. That was Bibs and Boots actually as well. But they were lifted off the streets and taken in by people that were not on the microchip, and the microchip wasn't scanned, and therefore the cats were put to sleep. And then we found out that actually you don't get the body back. The vets won't actually speak to you because they don't view you as being the client. The person who brings the animal in is the client. And that then resulted in the fact that, say, like, they don't get the bodies back, they can't find any information out about what happened. And it was the fact that it wasn't just Tuck, it was happening more often than anybody, I think, had anticipated.
And the other thing is, Julie, can I just jump in? The people that took those cats in, there was no recourse to them. They killed somebody else's animal.
Yeah.
And there was nothing. Because when the owners asked the vets for information or to see the file, the vets refused to give it. They quote see GDPR and protect the person who presents. They don't even have to be the owner of that animal. It's irrelevant. The vets will stand by the person that walks through that door, regardless of whether they own that animal or not.
Wow.
And there's absolutely nothing that you can do about it. There's no comeback to that person that's done it. I mean, that poor one of the owners actually lost three cats at that time. And there's nothing she could do.
Yeah. I mean, it's shocking. As you say, it's genuinely shocking. I don't want to, and I know you're not doing that. I know you're not doing that, but I don't want to vilify vets. They have a...
I'm not saying you're doing that.
I'm not saying, but, you know, just to be clear to anybody listening, we're not vilifying vets at all. They have a really hard job to do. I love our vets. You know, they're wonderful.
I mean, I think what highlighted that to us more than anything else was back in 2019, we actually had a meeting with the president of the Royal Veterinary College, which was Niall Cornell at the time. And Sue and I gave a presentation. We said, you know, that we gave examples of the dogs and the cat that had actually been, you know, been put to sleep. And I think it was the dogs predominantly, but the ones that had the rescue backup on their microchips. And he actually didn't know that it even existed.
Wow.
So that's what we're saying. We would never,
no,
you know, blame the vets or anything like that, because you can't act on something that you're not aware of.
No, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, saying that, so Tuck's Law, tell me about what is Tuck's Law?
Tuck's Law is our campaign, say, predominantly started with Tuck because he had a rescue backup registration on his microchip. That means that on the microchip database, there will be the contact information of the adopter,
yeah,
or foster, and there will also, as a secondary contact, be the rescue. And what we wanted was the rescue to remain on the contact sort of like database, so that every time the microchip was scanned up, it would flag.
Yeah.
But so that's sort of like what rescue backup is. It just means that the rescue is like a constant throughout the dog cat's life.
Yeah.
And if ever there's any time that they were going to become into sort of a vulnerable situation, then obviously the rescue, we hoped, would be contacted and the dog would be saved.
Yeah.
So that's really what the campaign is to have the recognition of rescue backup legally. It's what we want. Obviously, it was put into the Royal Veterinary College Code of Conduct, but there were specific circumstances that would have to play out. And what we're finding is that there's too many grey areas around it, and we don't believe that there's been enough awareness raised about it. You know, there's only Sue and I think we've done pretty well, you know, to get it up into Westminster and to, you know, into sort of like the media.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean to say that everybody actually understands what it is or why it's there.
No.
So that's really, I suppose, what we, you know, as much as sort of campaigning for it to be scanning, we're also really wanting an awareness campaign around it, so that there's more people that are aware that it's an option, because the databases now offer, well, some of the databases now offer that as standard. And it's also going to be put into the, I think, the new single point of contact.
Yeah.
So that it will also flag up on there. So,
yeah.
The thing is as well, people seem to think it won't happen to them.
Yes.
Yeah. And to think that it's somebody else's problem. And as Dawn has said, you know, we never thought for one second that there'd be anybody else but Tuck. And then all of a sudden, all these rescues and all these owners and actually breeders as well were contacting us. And it's opened all these other little areas that actually attach to the original reason that we started. Things like, you know, we did do a couple of petitions for a central recording of the numbers of healthy or treatable dogs, cats, who'd been euthanized, and there's no interest from the government in doing it. And obviously with the XL bullies, you know, that there must be thousands, thousands. And then we found with crematoriums, you know, unless you send an animal to them for an individual cremation, there's no details stored anywhere of group cremations. Wow. So all these animals are being potentially killed, sent for group cremations, and then unfortunately their remains go to landfill. From our point of view, as animal lovers, dog lovers, cat lovers, these animals have to count for something. Yeah. They have to be acknowledged. They have to be recognised. It doesn't take much to just keep a note of how many, or, you know, their name, their breed, their microchip number. And surely from health and safety, you'd like to think that that would be a case as well, but it's not.
Yeah.
And there's other things that Dawn and I are exploring as well. Not sure if we're going to sort of announce all that yet, but it opens so many other little avenues that is wrong, and it is wrong.
Yeah.
But like Dawn says, it's just the two of us and getting it out there. We asked for an awareness campaign with CBS and BBA. That's not happened. And for us to be able to single-handedly get the details of every single vet in the UK and contact every single one of them, you know, it would be lovely if they did. But then if that was to come from the RCBS, different story.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we did put a submission into there was a recent EFRA inquiry.
Yeah.
And I think it was the pet abuse inquiry. And we did put in a submission because what Sue and I had noticed on social media was that there were more and more calls for help from rescues or from pet owners saying, you know, that they were having no choice. They'd obviously bought the puppy in the pandemic. They'd found that either through economic reasons or going back to work or behaviour, because they weren't allowed to be socialised in the way that you would expect a puppy to normally be socialised, they were having issues with them. And so there was more people saying, you know, we need to rehome our dog because without this, the only alternative we have is euthanasia. So what Sue and I began to do was take a note of every single post that we saw, and it started building up, and then we submitted part of what we had to the EFRA inquiry, and it's online. You can have a look and see. And again, so like Sue said, we're asking, you know, for the sort of like the sex of the dog, the age, the breed, and the circumstances that were surrounding the sort of like the either the at risk or the being put to sleep.
Yeah.
So we did that, and we still continue to do that as well. So that's up online. But what we also noted as well, because there were objections, because we actually put three petitions in, and each time DEFRA came back basically saying that we hadn't proven that there was enough dogs at risk for it to actually warrant them spending any money on sort of research or anything like that. And what we said in the inquiry submission was that actually SavsNet is linked to Vet Compass, and I think they operate out of the University of Liverpool. And we've spoken to Dan O'Neill, we spoke to Justine Shotton from the BVA. The Kennel Club were also sort of quite supportive of what we were saying. And what we found was with SavsNet is it's linked to, I think, about 500 vet practices across the UK.
Yeah.
So it's not really that difficult, because if you know, we're not saying that there's vast amounts of, you know, of numbers, but equally we can't say there isn't, because there's no information available.
Yeah.
So there is that SavsNet, which is available to the vets, sort of like practices. They're all linked to the vet practices. So we're just asking for those four sort of like simple kind of sort of notes to be sent through to Vet Compass. And from there, they could actually look at the information that's being provided and look at maybe ways of I don't know whether it would be down to sort of like to say like to training, whether it is anything to do with breeds of dogs. You don't, you know, it can't all be about Excels. You know, there's going to be other areas that exist that maybe are not actually known because all the information isn't put into one central place. Mm-hmm. So that's really what we asked. And we are hopeful that DEFRA have taken on board, actually, because each time, you know, we put in we don't agree with the petition response that we've got. So, you know, the last petition that we put in, we've got again gone back and said, actually, we don't believe, you know, our information that we're collecting. And it's very small because you said it's only Sue and myself, and we're obviously limited to, you know, to social media posts that we're seeing or people telling us about different circumstances. There has to be a bigger picture looked at because there's so many dogs. You can find out how many dogs are put to sleep in pounds because they're subject to freedom of information requests. But one, we were told that the vets actually don't keep any figures anyway. And so you can't find, and they're not subject to freedom of information requests anyway. So even if the information was there, it wouldn't be freely available. Again, rescues and not subject to freedom of information requests. So again, you can't get any figures, you know, and we're not asking for the figures for ourselves, you know, and we're not asking for the figures to be made public kind of, you know. Again, there's no naming, shaming or anything because each case is individual.
Yeah.
You know, and there's going to be a story that's behind the reason why a dog is, you know, or a cat is taken in for euthanasia.
Yeah.
So it's just finding out what that is and if there's any interventions that could be put into place to look, you know, is it overbreeding? You know, where are these puppies coming from? Yeah. There's so many different avenues that it could go down. Mm. But essentially we need to have those figures actually recorded. And then people like Dan O'Neill at Vet Campus could actually look at it, analyse it and look at ways that it can be changed.
Yeah, yeah. Because microchipping, again, was sold as something that will encourage responsible breeding. You know, you can track exactly where dogs are coming from, who bred them or where they were brought into the country from or whatever. It was trackability, it was responsibility. So that should be happening. And if it's not, you're right, we need to look at ways we can, how can we make it happen? And I mean, saying that, how can people support you? It's just the two of you. I think it's brilliant. I love when people see a need and they just go, right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make this happen. I, you know, my hat is off to you. That is brilliant. I love that. How can we support you?
Sign a petition.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Sign a petition.
I mean, also, and write to your MP.
Yeah.
Yeah. MPs. Yeah, and also speak to your vets as well. Just tell them about us. And, you know, we've always said that we want to work with vets, not against them. And it would be lovely to have some vets or vet nurses. We've had a couple anyway, get in touch with us, because at the end of the day, what we're asking is something that they would have to do. So to speak to them and find a way that it can be done easily for them, it would be massive. And can I just jump in just very quickly? I know Dawn wants to speak, but you said about the microchips containing details of puppies and bred, you know, how they're bred and everything. The new, when the microchip consultation results came out the other week, they did say that they're going to store, I think, the mother of the puppy is going to be stored, I think, on the microchip from now on. Brilliant. So from that point of view, that's on there. As to everything else, remains to be seen. Sorry, Dawn, go on.
We did have a private members bill that was presented a few years ago, and that's still sort of knocking around in Westminster. We're obviously, there's a, you know, a big question mark over the fact that there's going to be a general election, you know, that's going to be coming down the road very shortly. Unfortunately, we've been a victim of a previous general election that was caused when we were sort of mid petition, and what happens is you end up losing all your signatures and you have to start again. So, you know, we really desperately need as many signatures as possible, because you are having to try and find 100,000 within a given sort of period of time. And while we did it once, you know, it's
hard work.
It wasn't an easy road to sort of like, you know, to walk really. Mm. But yeah, but obviously contacting your MP as well, because anything you can go on our page and anything that, you know, that we're highlighting, we would really appreciate people contacting their MP and saying, actually, do you know that this is an issue, and, you know, have you looked at the response from their latest petition, and just see whether we can get more MPs on board as well. You know, we know that we've got cross-party support for it, but as you say, you know, we just desperately need to have people signing and sharing the petition and asking questions, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like we said at the beginning, like Dawn said, you know, with the MPs and stuff, you know, this is something that could affect anybody. It's not a one-off. It's not just, you know, for rescues. It's not just for, it could happen to anybody. You know, if you've got a cat that you let the cat out, could happen to you. If you've got a dog, the dog's let off lead. If you let the dog in the garden, could happen to you. And it's one of those things that, you know, if you love animals and you look at your animals, and Dawn said the same thing, can't imagine it. And the people that we've spoken to, I mean, I can hand on heart, and I know I speak to Dawn as well, we have shed so many tears with the owners and the breeders, and the rescues, and actually some of the breeders as well. There's been a few, you know, that have been, we tried everything to get the body back, and it has affected some of these people, most, if not all of these people, for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, some mm-hmm. of them have ended up in therapy, it's been that bad. And you just want MPs to just actually speak to these people and understand just how horrendous it is. And it's when they say, you know, there's not enough of a problem, one is a problem. It doesn't matter. There should be none. And if there's one that it's happened to that's affected that family or it's affected that rescue, we know of rescues that have closed down after this happened. You know, we've known, like I say, owners that have literally, they just can't cope. And it shouldn't be happening. Not still be happening. And the fact that we're 5 years down the line, and there's even more over those 5 years. It was bad enough in the beginning, because obviously you hear stories of things that have happened years and years and years ago before we started. So we know the problem is a lot bigger than we're able to share. Sorry, I've got to be in a car. But, you know, it's just too sorry, it's just blowing.
Yeah, me. I mean, say, going back to the GDPR, I mean, what we've actually put on our new, like the latest petition, what we added, and we did have a lot of umming and ahhing and backwards and forwards with the petition committee, which is another story. But what we found is the fact that the Royal Veterinary College complaint sort of like process is not very easy. And again, that's not a reflection on the vets at all, because then they're not, you know, they don't make those kind of rules or anything like that.
Yeah.
But what we would like is the fact that whereas any complaints that have gone in previously to now, it's been very sort of like black and white, you know, and it's the, you know, the Royal Veterinary College and it's the rescue or the owner, and that's it. But what we're asking for is that it to be wider, because as soon as you start putting a barrier into place, as in the person who's standing in front of you is the client, and you're not taking into consideration that that person is not registered on the microchip at all, or, you know, then that shouldn't be a barrier to the actual rescue or the actual owner, the registered, you know, rescuer owner being able to find out any information. So that is part of it. And we did sort of have a bit of a like backwards and forwards, as you say, with the petition committee trying to get that part in, which is in there. So, you know, and again, so that is the kind of thing that can affect everything. So, well, while we started off with Tuck and Rescue Backup, what we found was that we sort of like opened a bit of Pandora's box, and we found that there was actually more to it than that. And as you say, that part of it that could affect anybody, you know, because it could be anybody's dog or cat that ends up, you know, being put to sleep, and you cannot find any information out about it. And that has to be wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if you can't, at the very least, if you can't, as an owner, get closure, and you don't know, that just goes on forever and ever and ever. And, you know, as you say, it devastates people. People just sometimes don't recover. It's just...
I mean, some people have actually turned around and said, actually, we can't continue with the process. You know, we've always said that, you know, Sue and I will help every step of the way, mm-hmm. you know, sort of like okay. to make sure that, and there have been sort of like rescues and, you know, individual sort of pet owners who have actually turned around and gone, you know, it's too heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
Like we actually can't keep going with this because it's destroying us. We're not, like you say, able to get any closure on it. And therefore it's just eating away at us all the time and they have to walk away from it. You know, and that again, it breaks us sometimes.
Yeah. And when they can't get the body back and they know, you know, there was one in particular or two, and, you know, obviously we can't mention any names, but, you know, we tried everything. We tracked the little dog's body down. We knew exactly where he was. We spoke to the crematorium, who were absolutely fantastic. They spoke to the owner, and cut long story short, that owner was not able to get his dog's remains back. And he was on the microchip. It was his dog. He was the owner. The dog wasn't a young dog. It wasn't a puppy. Mm-hmm. He'd had that dog for a very long time. He was put down without his permission by a vet who was not his vet. And he wasn't even able to bring the little dog's body to put him in the garden or to have him cremated individually and keep his ashes. He didn't have any closure. And then when he put the complaint in, unfortunately, again, we don't want to bash the RCVS, but one common thing that we do hear from a lot of people that put complaints in is the lack of empathy and the coldness that's in the responses that they get when the complaints have gone in.
Yeah.
It's almost like a standard response, and they never get they never go through. They should.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose when you have you know in that situation, I'm just trying to be fair, you know, when you are getting those complaints all the time, you can't break your heart over everyone. I can understand that you have to sort of be professional. I'm not trying to defend, but yeah, I can see from your face. But do you know what I mean? You can't, like, you'd be sitting there crying every day, but it's not right. We've got to address this.
We don't expect tears, but I think you would expect the person to be a little bit more
kind,
understanding.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we never once turned around and said that, you know, we wanted anybody to lose their job.
Oh, gosh, no, yeah.
Anything like that, you know. Yeah. What we've always said is the fact that unless you are willing to acknowledge that there was some kind of, say, error, but, you know, like that there was an error, like, say, it's in the code of conduct to scan. Yeah. You know, and again, say it is under given circumstances, and we know that people go in and they lie and they'll say that the dog's bitten and it hasn't, because, you know, as soon as you mention anything like that, it then becomes a welfare sort of like concern. But sometimes you need to sort of like just take a step back, maybe look at the person who's in front of you, the fact that you've got a, you know, maybe a waggy kind of towed dog that's young, healthy, and you're thinking, you know what, maybe there is an alternative, you know, because like you said, like behaviour can be such a sliding scale that what is going to be acceptable for one sort of owner is not going to be acceptable for another.
Yeah.
And that can only be taken into consideration if a lot more questions are asked when somebody walks in and makes that request of euthanasia, as to whether, like, well, let's take a step back, let's have a look, you know, let's see what the circumstances are, you know, and let's see whether there's an alternative. Sometimes that's not going to be registered on the microchip because there's not going to be a breeder, there's not going to be a rescue available. But equally, we've had rescues that have been rung by vets saying, like, can you please come and help, you know, help this dog? And we've had a rescue outside a vet practice, another one that's, you know, on the phone to the vet, and still that dog has ended up losing its life. And that can't, you know, again, that's they're just, you know, what we want, I suppose, out of everything is that there needs to be more questions asked. When we had our debate back in, I think it's 2022, I think it might have been, I think Victoria Prentice said that she was who was the sort of DEFRA minister at the time, she was going to be open to sort of looking at and monitoring what was happening. And I think Jane Stevenson MP stood up and said that she felt that there needed to be another debate just on euthanasia, so that we could all look and see exactly what's happening. And again, that actually hasn't happened. And the problem is for us is the fact that unless it's your actual MP, they won't speak to us. So we could contact every MP in the country, and unless we're in their constituency, they won't speak to us, which is why we really sort of, as much as signing, it's really helpful for people to contact their MP and just say, look, are you aware of this campaign? Do you understand what the premise of it is? And will you speak to them?
Wouldn't it be brilliant if everyone listening to this in the UK contacted their MP and made a stand for all the dogs, all the pets, all the people affected by this? We have a new government in the UK. It's a time for change, of making things better. Let's all get behind Tuck's Law and make things better for our beloved pets. The links you need are on the Dogcast Radio site at dogcastradio.com. The petition is currently closed because of the election, and the best place to go to find out more is tuckslaw.com. That's tuckslaw.com. The best of luck to Sue and Dawn. And the best of luck to all of you, because frankly, I've crammed in as much as I possibly can in this podcast, and I need to go and have a lie down. Well, actually, I need to go and check up on Diamond and see what chaos she's causing, while Mischief looks on with the wise disapproval of an older sister who is above all that puppy silliness. Thank goodness she is, because I couldn't cope with two silly puppies at once. Until next time, look after yourselves and your dogs. Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. A client brought a litter of golden retriever puppies to the veterinary clinic for inoculations and deworming. As the lookalike pups squirmed over and under one another in their box, the vet realised it would be difficult to tell the treated ones from the rest. The vet turned on the water faucet, wet her fingers, and moistened each dog's head when she'd finished. After the fourth puppy, the vet noticed the hitherto talkative client had grown silent. As the vet sprinkled the last pup's head with water, the woman leaned forward and whispered, "I didn't know they had to be baptised as well."